Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 24, delivered on November 15, 2018. The title of this lecture is Net Present Value and Internal Rate of Return.
Today, net present value and internal rate of return. Now, as I had said, I would like to have you have your computers or your calculators with you so that we can just do some of these problems and walk through the ways that it works. The first thing that I will do to start the ball rolling is I'll just do a very simple example that we will pull out on the TI-83 calculator on your emulator, or if you have a real version of it. Hey, there's lots of lights in here. Okay. A project requiring an initial investment of $220,000 will bring cash flows of the following. Year free cash flow. Year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So at the beginning, of course, we'll have the negative amount, 220,000. And then in year one, the project just begins to eke out positive free cash flow of, let's say, $40,000. Year two, it's picked up some speed and we're up to $60,000. Year three, we're getting underway with the project at $80,000. Year four, we are pulling hard with $50,000, still pulling on the project with $50,000. And in year five, this is the termination year, in which case we have a free cash flow of $30,000, and we have a salvage value, which is a somewhat positive number, of another $10,000. Costs plus unloading your last inventory minus any additional expenses, ending it, and all of that. And again, I will caution you that that last number, salvage value, is going to be something. Sometimes the pluses and the minuses sort of balance each other out, but in some cases they don't, and you get a big positive or a big negative number. But always pay attention to the salvage value. Now, the next thing we're going to do is we'll pull a discount rate out of thin air. But again, remember, the discount rate you would actually calculate by the capital asset pricing model or by some other method. So, wait a minute. Let's do something here. Okay, let's take a discount rate No, I'm tired of guessing discount rates. Madam, give me a discount rate. You're a finance major, right? You're a finance major, right?
Sure.
Good. Okay. No, not sure. Yes. Yes, by golly. Give me a discount rate. You got one?
5%.
5%. A worthy discount rate. Now, that would mean that this is probably a pretty low-risk project. Out of 5%, we're saying this is a low-risk project. So let's go 5%. Okay. So now, clear. Get the calculator clear. Now, apps, finance. Choice 7 is net present value, NPV, and that pops you back to the main screen. NPV, open parenthesis. Now, the first thing you're going to want to do is put in your discount rate. In this case, we have our chief financial officer has pronounced that 5% is the discount rate. And again, these calculators want to see a comma if you're finished giving a piece of data. Comma. So the next thing that you'll need for the NPV is the initial cash outflow, which in this case is negative $220,000. Now notice that it doesn't matter if I'm doing only 220 as long as I maintain the same scale across the cash flows. Okay, then we say that's done, so that's a comma. We're done with that piece of data. Now, for the TI-83 to know that you are about to give it positive free cash flow, you start with an open brace, which is second parenthesis. It amazes me how many students come and they say, I've put it in right, and I notice, oh, that's a parenthesis. It's actually not easy to see the difference on this little pixelated screen that they have on these, but there it is. Open. And now you just pump those cash flows in there. We had, what was it to begin with? 10 grand, then 60 grand. So we got 10. Wait, 40 is the first one? Oh, we're doing better than what I thought with the sales. Hooray for the marketing team. 40, comma, then it was 60. Then comma, what was next? 80. And then comma, what came next? 50. And then at the end, we have 30 plus 10. Always put the salvage value on the back end. So in that last year, we have a 40. Now, we close the parentheses. Close the brace. I'm sorry, second close parenthesis. And then you close the actual parenthesis. Huh?
It's just an open parenthesis.
Is that an open parenthesis?
Yeah.
That one right there? You mean?
No, the first one.
That came out not to be a brace? Oh, you're right. Wow. So I'm doing exactly what I warned you guys not to do there. And it's really hard to see that that isn't a brace. Especially on my screen. On yours, I suppose you can see it a little better. But second, open the brace. And then down. Now we close. Are you happy now? Now that it'll actually not give me an error? Close the parenthesis. Now enter. 14. Oh, it's $14,100. So the NPV is $14,100. Don't worry about pennies. Now, so accept or reject? Accept or reject? Absolutely. Again, I can't emphasize this enough. In business decision making, you need to bring it down to a yes or a no. And this is where you're seeing this in practice. And if you're ever in a business course where they have no place where a yes or a no finally happens, you know that the course isn't showing you how business really works. Sooner or later, we've got to have a yes or a no. And not a maybe. In this case, yes, it's a positive net present value project. Well, you're saying to yourself, well, that's actually not that positive. Who cares? It's positive. That's the whole matter. You understand that 14,000 positive NPV against an initial investment of 220,000 doesn't look all that great, but that doesn't matter. It is positive net present value. In other words, based upon the risk of this project, reflected in the discount rate that we used, this is a good project. Absolutely, we take this on. And generally speaking, this almost gets into a philosophical argument. Why will businesses take on every positive net present value project they come across? The answer should be yes. But the real world says that, unfortunately, some businesses get into what are called capital constraints, where as they use more money, the cost of their money gets worse and worse. No matter whether they use equity or debt or internal retained earnings, it just gets to the point where, yeah, these are great projects, but realistically, as soon as we try to take it on, that freaking discount rate goes up through the roof because the risk of the project gets bad because we have to borrow so much or we have to issue so much equity to do it. That's a problem because you see in huge corporations, oligopolies and monopolies, they never hit capital constraints. So they can just take on whatever they want, whenever they want, for as long as they want. They have no control over, they have no break on them. That is what happens with a company like a Google. It's so huge that it will just take on anything it finds its positive NPV. But a smaller company, more innovative, probably a better company, more efficient, can't do it because it would hit capital constraints if it took on too many projects. So it gets kind of philosophical there, but anyway. Now, let's go back and find the internal rate of return of this project. It's probably going to be not much different from 5%. Considering that 5%, look, here's NPV, here's the discount rate. Here at 5%, the project, comparatively speaking, compared to its initial costs, which were huge, at 5%, this project had a somewhat positive NPV. So we know that the NPV line goes downward like that. So we know it's going to cross not too far above 5%. Now, for a little bit of trickery with your calculator. Okay, let's do the internal rate of return. But let's not put in all the stupid numbers again, because I might make a mistake like I did the last time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to edit the function, second, enter. That takes me into edit mode. Now I'm going to take the cursor and put it back up on the NPV word, letters. Right? It doesn't matter. It'll just go to the first letter in the NPV. Now watch what I'm going to do. Apps, finance, and now I'm going to toggle down to internal rate of return, number 8. Enter. Oh, look, it just replaced my NPV with IRR. And now all I have to do is delete the percent because the IRR doesn't want a percent. It's finding your percent, so I just go delete the 5 and delete the comma, and now I hit enter. Oh, that was a little higher than I thought it'd be. Okay, you see how you do it? You just edit the function and then replace the IRR with the NPV with IRR and then get rid of the discount rate and comma that you used for the NPV. And we find that the internal rate of return of this project is 7.30%. The internal rate of return is 7.30%. Now, yeah. Bingo. If I put in, you beat me to my little, no, that's okay. Now watch what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back, and this time I'm going to take it back to NPV, and I'm going to put in 7.30% and see, we should get something very close to a zero NPV. Okay, second edit. Okay, now I'm going to go back up, and I'm going to take it back over to the IRR function, the word IRR, or the letters, and I'm going to go apps, finance, and then I'm going to hit NPV. See, now it replaces the IRR with NPV. But now I have to insert, second insert, 7.3, comma. By the way, you see that once you hit insert, as long as you just keep pushing numbers, it'll keep inserting instead of overriding. It's a quickie thing. If you understand what I'm doing here, great. If you don't, it's not going to kill you. Now enter. Whoa, less than a penny. Yeah. Or less, actually, that's less than a dollar because it was, or something like that. You see how that was indeed exactly the point. It was at the internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. That's what I did here. Now, it's not exactly zero because I rounded the IRR number to two decimal places. And again, look, realistically, NPV to the nearest dollar is more than sufficient. I don't know, different companies have different policies. We want these calculations to the nearest penny, to the nearest dollar, to the nearest $10, to the nearest tenth of a cent. It all depends on house rules, but for me, to the nearest dollar is fine when you're calculating net present values, and for discount rates, two decimal places is more than enough in college work. With percentages out in the real world, you want to have a whole lot of decimal places because when you're dealing in millions and billions of dollars, even a hundredth of a percent can be a whole lot of money. But that's out there. Now, the next thing here is to bring up Excel and do this in Excel. And it's so in a problem like this, and I'm going to do this fairly simplistically, but I'm also going to do a little tiny bit of sophistication. But first, we'll want the year and the free cash flow. And it's a year zero, year one. And I mean, if you got a lot of years, this is just grab the handle and drag it down. What did we have, a five-year project? Was that a five-year? Yeah. Okay, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the free cash flows were negative 220,000, negative 40,000, or positive 40,000. Then 60,000, 80,000. Wait, something's wrong here. 40, 60, 80. Year three should have been 80. Well, I guess so. And then 50. And then watch what I'm going to do here. Watch. 30,000 plus. Now I'm going to put salvage value up here in E1. The salvage value, and I'll get an error to begin with, 10,000. Oops. plus E1. Oops, equals, that's a calculation, equals. Now a couple of things are going to happen here. I'm going to put in salvage value, salvage in E1. Oops, that should be E2 I put down there. And then over here, discount rate. And I'm going to fix this. That's an E2. And the salvage value that I decided. Now, the reason I'm doing this is salvage was 10,000. And the discount rate is 5%. The reason I did it this way is so that if I need to go back and correct the salvage value, but everything else is fine, I don't have to go back into the core data stream. Something that is kind of important when you're doing Excel is to make your data vector so that you don't need to go back and edit it. You edit things around it that affect it. But once you've got that core data in there, you want to make that one of those things, and especially when you get into a company where you've got idiots, you want to protect that. You'll want to probably even lock. See that column there, B2? You'll want to lock that sucker so that it can't be played with by frisky little hands who think they know Excel or want to manipulate the data. So that's why you see me sometimes doing a trick like this, so that what happens with that core data is under my full control, and only peripheral action can affect the numbers that I'm getting calculating from it. Okay, so now, it gets really simple from here. I mean, it's almost embarrassing. It's like NPV equals NPV, open parenthesis, and my rate is here. And I'll probably make that an absolute reference, F4, just so if I move the data around, the referencing cell stays the same. And then comma, and then I give it the whole data vector. Notice that in Excel, the data vector is considered an integral thing. In TI, they consider the initial cash flow as something separate from the free cash flow of the project. And it's just a difference, and then I can say enter. Oops. I shouldn't have done it there. Let me delete that and do it there. Let me type in NPV here. And then equals NPV, open parenthesis, absolute reference on F1, on F2, and then comma, there's my cash flow, free cash flow stream there, enter. Notice, by the way, you don't have to close the last parenthesis in a formula in Excel. In an algebraic calculation, you must. But you don't technically have to close a parenthesis. Okay, there's your net present value. You see a problem?
Yeah.
It's different from TI. Right. Yeah. Actually, I'm going to tell you the secret. I know what it has to do with. It's aliens. Aliens, that's the explanation for anything that's really weird. This happens, and I swear to you, it is something that... Now, I might have entered something wrong in here. I don't think I did. But if I entered everything right in here, you will see Excel give answers that are not the same as the answers on calculators. Almost always.
guys. The Excel answers will be very close to the answers you would get in Hewlett-Packard financial calculators, HPs. They are a pain in the butt to work with, but they are extraordinary calculators. But with TIs, this can happen. And I'm going to leave it at that. Don't bother me about it anymore, okay? If you get any answer wrong on the homework, well, tough. Internal rate of return. Now, that equals, IRR. Is the values, just give it the values. Now, technically, you could give the, put a comma and say, here's a good guess. Because otherwise, you're making this stupid Excel program work probably 100,000 calculations. Try this number, try that number, go back and forth and back and forth. Until it gets to the right one. Now, if you don't like to make your Excel calculator, your Excel work that hard, you could give it a place to start that might help it a little bit. It depends on whether you want to be friends with your Excel or not. I don't need friends, so I'm not giving it a guess. And then we'll go around that format to two decimal places, percent to two decimal places. Isn't that annoying? Look at that. It is dead on with the internal rate of return. And I see that, and I've finally gotten tired of trying to make excuses for it. Your internal rate of return will come out dead on almost every time. The NPV might be off. You know, by a little bit, in this case, like $10,000 or something like that. But there you go. That's just how it is. The IRRs are dead on. Now, and this is all there is to that. Now, there are a couple of points to bring up. There are times. Okay, suppose that you are in a situation where you have mutually exclusive projects. You cannot do both projects. Think about it this way. You, madam, we got two projects, and you're the only one person who could handle these kinds of projects. But you can't handle both because you're going to be working 20-hour days on either one. And if we put you on both, I mean, you're just going to... I mean, yeah, we can slip some extra things into your morning coffee to help you move along, but... practically speaking, we can't have you do both projects. We own a piece of land. There are two alternate projects that we could use that land for. We can't use it for both of them, but we can use it for either of them. This is actually not that unusual to run into mutually exclusive projects. And sometimes it simply has to do with the fact that yeah, we could take on both of them. They're both great projects. But on each one on its own, the bank is going to be okay with lending us at 8%. But if we ask for the money to do both of them, the bank is going to jack the marginal, the last dollar we borrow, up to somewhere along the way, up to 13%. Meaning that we completely, the projects taken each, are under the weighted average cost of capital is great, but if we take them both, it whacks our whole whack. And so we have to do a recalculation, and neither of them is worth it if we do them both because the cost of capital is too high for both of them. Again, though, the idea here is, what do we do with mutually exclusive projects? Well, clearly, we want both of them. Now, watch this. Project A, Project B, and they are mutually exclusive suckers. Now, let's look at the NPV and the IRR.
So the NPV of the first project is positive $12,000. The NPV of the second project is positive $10,000. They're both positive except the internal rate of return of project A is 13.5%. The internal rate of return of project B is 16.2%. And our hurdle rate is 10%. So both of these projects are yes. They both cross the hurdle rate, yes.
Do they have a salvage value?
Oh, we did that in the NPV. We did that in the NPV. It has to have been there. Now here's the problem, though. We can't take them both. And yet they're both yes. And even worse, our two decision-making criteria, NPV and IRR, give us opposite answers for which one to take. It happens. When I was in university and I saw this, it would just kind of didn't mean much to me. And in my third year of consulting, I actually ran into that. I ran into a company that was facing this problem. And I thought, there's got to be, and actually I looked at salvage values, I looked at free cash flows, see if there was something I could tweak, and I thought, it actually can happen. You can have two yes projects, but one is would be preferable. See, by NPV rules, we would take project A. By internal rate of return rules, we would take project B. And so what's a mother to do in a situation like this? I'll tell you, the problem is that this goes back to a really deep argument among finance professionals. Which is a better method? They're both best practices. Which one is better, NPV or IRR? The answer that I give you is NPV, and you'll see why in a minute. But most corporations are going to say IRR. Guarantee you, internal rate of return is what they look at. That's actually, interestingly enough, though, you see that in a kind of way, it with this problem, it doesn't matter. They've got a winner either way. But if I were CFO, I would say A. But almost never would you hear a CFO do that. He would say, she would say, Project B. No question. It's farther away from the hurdle rate. And so it's obviously a much better return on investment than Project A. Even though Project A would have a higher Jensen's alpha off the capital market line. Oddly enough. In other words, it would give a more abnormally high return. In other words, they both give an abnormally high return, but Project A gives an even more abnormally high return than Project B, even though Project B has a return on investment that is better than Project A. In other words, Project B is actually a riskier project, and it's a good project. But Project A is less risky, and for the dollars you invest, it is a higher return project for the risk that is taken. So A is a lower risk, higher return project. B is a higher risk, high return, but not as high. Anyway, I'm not going to ever test you on that. But if you ever get out there in the RW and run into something like this, the real world, know that this is what's going on. Now, I'm going to show you about internal rate of return. I'm going to do something terrible to you. I'm going to take you back to your dark past. I mean, I'm taking you back to some really ugly stuff that happened years ago. You've put it out of your mind. You don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm talking about high school algebra. And I'm not talking just about high school algebra. I am talking about polynomial algebra. Remember polynomials? Don't shake your head at me. I know you do. You're just denying it. See, you're in denial.
You've blocked it out of your mind. And that's what I'm trying to get you. You're never going to be a fully developed person until you come to grips with what happened. Okay? Seriously. The polynomials, you remember the linear equation, the quadratic equation, the cubic equation, all those ones and the graphs. A linear equation is an equation of degree one. In other words, the highest power to which the x occurs is the first power. And that will make a straight line. A quadratic equation is an equation where the highest power is 2. That's a second degree polynomial. It can hit the x-axis at most 2 times. A cubic equation is a third degree polynomial. It can hit the axis at most 3 times. Watch. And there's a reason I'm doing this. There's a reason I'm doing this. Look, a first degree polynomial would be something like 2x plus 3. It looks like this, x-axis 3. See, it hits the x-axis once. A straight line can hit the x-axis only once. We say it has at most one root. A second degree would be something like 4x squared minus 3x plus 1. That's a parabola, or a parabola if you're Italian. At most, it can hit the x-axis twice. It could hit it once if it nicks and goes back up, or 0 if it completely misses. But at most, it has 2 roots. The roots are where it slaps the x-axis. A third degree polynomial is something like x cubed minus 2x squared plus 3x minus 1. That is one that's shaped like this. At most, it can hit the x-axis 3 times. You're saying, where the hell are you going with this, boy? Etc. Interestingly, notice that that odd degree polynomials always have to hit the x-axis at least once. Now, what in the heck does that have to do with net present value and internal rate of return or finance? It's this. The problem is that if you have a project, now see how this project and the ones that I've done so far always had the sign of the free cash flow switch once from negative to positive. In other words, it's a first degree polynomial. It's a line. See how I drew that? That's a linear equation. It's a line. You graph those NPVs, they'll make a line. They're pretty. They'll go, whoa, like that. Hit the x-axis once. In other words, one internal rate of return. But if that son of a bitch, or that thing, hits the x-axis more than once. In other words, if the sign changes more than one time, negative, positive, positive, and then a negative and a positive, positive, it becomes a second or third degree polynomial. It hits the axis more than once. In other words, if the sign changes more than once, your NPV function can end up looking like this. You have 2 internal rates of return. Well, which one's right? Neither of them. They're both what we call spurious. They are meaningless. They have no explanation. And if you put it into a calculator, like a TI, the calculator will actually give you an internal rate of return. Like it knows what it's doing. The reason it will do it is because it will have started over on one of them, and it will then just start locking in, fishing for the 0 on that one. Whichever one that it starts to look for closest to is the one that it will find, and then it will report, here's your internal rate of return. No problem. Oh, yeah, there's a big problem. It has no meaning because there was another one it didn't find, and neither of them has any use. internal rates of return have this nasty feature. They work only if you have a project that has only one change of sign in free cash flow. Now, that is actually not all that realistic sometimes. There were a number. I mean, I saw it in my own work. You would have a project. Think about it this way. This company did a consumer product. It was actually kind of a cool thing. And they put in, to start the ball rolling, it was close to $70,000. Getting the prototypes, a plastic injection mold built in Taiwan, and then getting everything set up, getting inventory built up, that 0 year was about 70 grand in the dark. And then the project got underway. And quite honestly, I blew it on the, I thought, well, this project's going to take probably 2 to 3 years of really intense marketing to get anything, to start getting anything really good as far as positives. I was projecting like 5,000 first year. I don't remember, but it was weekly positive. Unfortunately, son of a dog, that product picked up steam in about 18 months. The orders coming in were substantially larger, and it was just to the point where, okay, we're going to have to put a lot more money into this, or we're going to blow our chance. Because if you don't keep pushing a product, you know, strike while the iron's hot, it'll just die away. So that meant getting a larger injection mold built in Taiwan, one that was going to cost a lot more, getting 3 more trucks to start moving this product to the shelves regionally instead of in just a couple of towns, and a bunch of other. So in year 3, the free cash flow went negative again because of all that new investment we had to do. And then it came positive the next year after that because we were back in business at a bigger scale. So it went negative, positive, positive, negative, positive, positive. That's not that unusual. Somewhere along the way, you have to stop, take a breather, and get this project up to a bigger level. Or, in some cases, if the project is just flopping around and you're not doing it well, you'll have to stop and reinvent the product. Figure out, okay, what are we doing wrong here? Let's pour more money in. If it's a good investment, we do all that analysis, and then we move forward from there. So, yeah, the cash flow can actually change sign several times. Another bad thing that can happen is there are projects that can have positive free cash flow in year 0 and then bloody negative free cash flow in year one or two, before they recover to free cash flow positive again in year 3 or 4. In other words, they start out with positive free cash flow, and then they have one or two years of blood, red ink, and before they come back into free cash flow. Does anyone know how that can happen? Well, you can have, right out of the gate, you can have a bunch of positive free cash flow, but only the next year do you get negative free cash flow. Yeah? Bingo, Yahtzee. You get angel investors put their money in. That's free cash flow. That's positive free cash flow. And then you're flopping around trying. It takes maybe about 6-10 months to get all of the work schedules together. And then finally you start paying bills. And it's only into the first year, not year 0, it's in year 1, that you start spending the money. So you can have positive, negative, negative, positive, positive. So sign switch is not that unusual. Net present value has no problem with it. It's just a, okay, we'll just do this. But internal rate of return completely blows the product. However, God knows that they are not going to be deterred. Those who love internal rate of return are not going to be deterred. So they invented this abomination hated by God called the modified internal rate of return. Do you know how that works? Let me show you free cash flow.
Here's the year. Here's the project. Free cash flow. You're 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Now I'll do this one clean and I'll do it off the gate, minus $220,000. And then in year one, we're going to have $40,000. And then in year two, we're going to have our, let's do $80,000 in year two. And then we're going to have negative $30,000 in year three before we recover to $60,000. And we'll have zero salvage value this time. We'll just do, we'll have a salvage value. We'll do $30,000 with a salvage this time of $20,000. Now, doing the internal rate of return, we're not going to do the internal rate of return right away. I'm just going to do the net present value of this sucker. Salvage will be, let's rewrite these numbers, and we'll have the 40. Now, then we'll have 80,000, and then we'll have negative 30,000. And then we'll recover to 60,000. And then we will have 30,000. Well, I can actually leave that one alone and just put my salvage value over here. Now, it might be giving me an error at this point. Oh. At a discount rate of 5%, this is now a negative net present value project. And NPV is perfectly legit. We reject. If you're happy with that, go home. It's time for lunch. If you live near where you work, which means you don't work in downtown Chicago, unless you live on the streets near Monroe. It's not bad. There's a really good Chinese restaurant in this alleyway right across from the Chase Tower. I wouldn't recommend going there at night down that alley because the food's really not worth dying for. But anyway, where the hell was I? Okay. Now you see that this is a negative net present value project at 5%. Now if I were to reach here a little farther, I could probably, I'm guessing that this one's going to need maybe 10% before it's going to look worthwhile. Nope. Let's try 20%, by God. Seriously? This thing sucks. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. I'm sorry. 2%. Gee whiz. Wow. Oh, this thing is going to suck.com no matter what I do on it. I'm going to make a quick modification here because otherwise I've got a project that I can't do much with. Let's say that it actually was really incredible there. Let's go to $90,000 in year four. Okay, I really got a bad project here. Let's go to $100,000 in year two. I wasn't expecting this project. Ah, yeah, see, there's your positive net present value project at 2%. Wonder what happens at 4%. I'm betting that it's probably going to fall apart at 4%. Oh, it's still okay. Okay, well, this is good then. So the actual free cash flows are going to be negative 220, positive 40, positive 100, negative 30, positive 90, and then 30,000 with a salvage value of 20,000. That gets us back into the ball game. And it's positive even at the 5%. Nope, it's not. Somewhere between 4 and 5%, it drops. So we'll leave it at 4%. Now,
I'm not even going to do the internal rate of return calculation because Excel will probably, depending upon the version of Excel, it'll give me an answer. But it's a wrong answer because there is no internal rate of return. Here's how they do it. Here's the modified internal rate of return. Now, the book simplifies it, and we'll do it this simpler way, but I'll explain to you that technically you use two different rates. You use the weighted average cost of capital, the WACC. Let me write these down. Where? What was it? That was 40 and then 100. And then it was negative 30. And then 90 and 50. What's the 20,000 over here? Now, so that's a 50. Here's how it works. You use the weighted average cost of capital to discount back the negative cash flows to the present value. So you take the present value of the $220,000 negative, which is $220,000 because it's happening right now, plus the present value of negative $30,000 3 years out. You take those two present values and add them up. Then you take your positive cash flows and you take them out to the last year of the project. And you use for your compounding rate, you use the rate of reinvestment the company can get for funds. So it's a pain in the ass. And then what you have is you have one big negative number here, one positive giant negative number, positive number here at the end, and then you just take this number at the end and discount it back and see if it's bigger than the one at the beginning. Huh? Yeah. Now, in the way the book presents it, they use the same discount rate for the discounting and for the compounding. So you use the same, essentially use the weighted average cost of capital for both of them. So watch what happens when I do that, and for God's sake, use Excel for this, because otherwise it gets to be a real pain in the ass. Okay, now. Equals MIRR. Open parenthesis. Now, the first thing you're going to want to do is tell it the numbers that you want it to use for free cash flow. And then you're going to want to use a rate. Notice how it expects you to use a discount rate that is your weighted average cost of capital, comma, a reinvestment rate. So in this case, we're just going to use the same rate for both of them, okay? Because that's what the book says. Don't worry about a distinction between them. So I'll just go comma, 4%, comma, 4%. Uh-oh, that's not going to work. Yeah, well. Well, duh. Delete. Okay. Second C. Okay, let's try that again. MIRR. Now, let me use another discount rate. We'll use 5%, okay? So I'm going to say equals MIRR. MIRR, cash flow, comma, and I'm just going to say, I think I might have to put this in as a decimal. I'm just checking this. Oops. Yeah, there it is. That's okay. It worked. You have to use a decimal for those in Excel, okay? Use a decimal. But the modified internal rate of return for the project is 4.67%. Now, final question. Accept or reject? On this basis, would you accept or reject? What was your cost of capital that I used? What was it? What was my cost of capital that I used? What did I put in the formula there? You see it? What was it? Tell me, what was it? What was my cost of capital? Look up there at the formula. What did I use for the first, after the first comma? 5%. What did the internal rate of return of the project come out to be? So do I accept or reject? I reject because the internal rate of return didn't meet the cost of capital. That's MIRR. It's a pain in the butt. Just know how to do it. That's all I have for you. All right, thank you.